supposed to be Saturday?
What day is it today?
Wednesday.
Exactly.
Welcome to Film Fight Club. I'm Glenn Valentine from Falcon Screen, and we are joined by Sydney filmmaker Chris Evans.
Hey, guys.
And Oscarologist and radio commentator Louise Easton. Louise, thank you so much for joining us.
Hello, it's my pleasure. I'm here to address the gender diversity issue of Film Fight Club, much like the Oscars itself.
Which we're getting straight into, because it is the big story of the week. Oscars. I think Oscars handled it not necessarily... Who are we to criticise, but Oscars haven't handled it necessarily well.
No, I think that would be an understatement. And I don't think they handled it particularly well in the ceremony either, for that matter. Having said that, the great news of the night was, of course, Parasite's win for Best Film and Best Director.
It is. Just to note, Brittany Rule will be joining us in a little bit. And later in the program, we were talking about Emma, the new film of the general adaptation, which is in cinemas tomorrow. And later on the podcast, we'll be talking Uncut Gems, What Did Jack Do, and The True History of the Killer Gang, all of which are streaming on different notes. So we're on Netflix.
Two on Netflix, one on Stan. Yep.
But first, yes, the big news of the day is an unexpected win for in quite a few categories.
Yeah, just for Parasite, really. I think it would have been the most boring Oscar ceremony in living memory had it not been for that upset. It didn't really go down very well.
People are calling it an upset, but the day before, or a couple of days before the Oscars, someone said, "What's going to win?" And I said, "Parasite." Like, I don't think I'm some genius predictor. Like, I feel like you could see the momentum was there.
Well, Gold Derby, which is sort of the forefront on these things, predicted 1917. But to some extent, you're right, Chris. If you look at the last Best Picture winners of the last few years, it's always been the number two. Like, it's never been, you know, it's never going to be something like Little Women or Ford versus Ferrari. It's always going to be one of those two.
Yeah.
And it tends to go to the underdog, really.
Yeah, I felt the momentum too, but I honestly thought till the end that 1917 would do it. But as soon as I saw no acting nods, not in writing, not in directing, just cinematography, okay, Paris has the momentum here, it's going to take it. And as soon as Jane Fonda came out, as soon as she looked at the envelope and had that ticket pressed...
But for me, it wasn't until that directing win for Bong, who was really expected. I think that was an even closer race, the best director, than it was for best picture.
Probably.
I think everyone saw Sam Mendes winning. He'd won all the awards up until then.
And 1917 is such a look at me, I'm a director movie.
Exactly.
I'm glad Deakins did well. There are films I think deserve cinematography over it, including The Lighthouse,
I don't think 1917 should even have been nominated. Parasite had better cinematography.
Parasite did have better cinematography.
And it wasn't nominated.
It also had...
I think Deakins is a living legend.
I mean, okay, I know you're not the biggest fan of 1917,
that's true.
But if you had any kind of love for it whatsoever, that love had to go for the cinematography.
The thing about the cinematography is really... does it... when we talk about 1917, is it really... best cinematography? It's more something else that people are flipping out on, which is kind of like the choreography combined with the editing in order to mask those cuts and the visual effects.
I agree. I think one of the biggest snubs was, of course, editing for 1917, which was great.
Yeah, but I think honestly 1917 should have been in for editing.
Yeah,
but,
I agree.
But I'm very fine with how editing. I think Parasite should have won editing. Well, it did win best editing in the end, and as well as best sound editing, moreover, and more importantly, is Ford v Ferrari. The final sequence, the racing sequences in the final act were spectacularly well put together. I'm not just talking about the racing sequences. I mean the jumping between the Christian Bale character and Shelby, played by Matt Damon. There were completely different sides. There were no communication. There were different parts of the track, but you felt the synergy between them much better than you ever seen replicated in other racing films. So I appreciated that. I wasn't a fan of Ford v Ferrari. It should have been nominated for Best Picture, but I liked that it got the editing wins.
The thing about the 1917 cinematography is, like what I was saying before, Deakins is amazing, right? I think there's a few scenes that seem designed to show off, look at what Deakins can do. Like when the flare goes up in the air, it's a cinematography tech demo.
Well, all those night scenes.
But for the most
For
the most part, doesn't the cinematography in 1917 look kind of flat? Understandably so, because there's a constantly moving camera, so there's not really much room to
but all those
hide
focus
the tools.
and some of them were spectacular.
Yeah.
I just feel like there are more impressive looking films. I think 1917 couldn't have had mind-blowing take your breath away cinematography just because of the way it was made.
Yeah, I think we have to look at cinematography as a technical feat rather than an endurance feat. I appreciate that from the perspective Deakins did better than many other categories. Certainly, we've seen it replicated and even better in the likes of Victoria and other films. Mm. I would still give it to Parasite just for the quality of
Parasite wasn't even nominated. It was strange because that's actually some really beautiful lighting.
Yeah. But speaking of, it did make history yesterday. Best international feature and best film, the first Korean language film to win an Oscar ever, the first non-English language film to win best picture, the best director nod for director Bong, and best screenplay.
Yeah, so it's a huge... all of which first for a foreign language film, which is great.
Yeah, it's strange because for years the Oscars have actually been biased against Asian films.
Oh, absolutely.
There was the big breakthrough for Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, but outside of that, Asian films can't win best foreign language on our international film, historically.
They've gotten nominations, but that's pretty much it.
Yeah, never wins. So for this to actually go all the way... to Best Picture really is historic. It shows the times are changing, I guess.
Yeah, it was a nice moment. I think my favorite was actually when he won Best Director. There was a nice... you saw Martin Scorsese cheering and Todd Phillips just kind of sitting there just, you know, trying to look gracious.
I think Todd Phillips knew he was never going to win.
I honestly thought he would win.
Sam Mendes thought he was going to win Best Director. Did you see his face when they announced Bong?
Absolutely. Everyone thought it was going to be Sam Mendes.
I think that was
fun. It was funny as well when Bong did his acceptance speech and he sort of goes, oh, and Martin Scorsese, you know, and Martin Scorsese gets a standing ovation, which is really awesome to see. But then he sort of goes, oh, yeah, and you other directors are also really impressive and I want to split the Oscar five ways, not just one.
Well, Tarantino has been a supporter of his films for a long time, as he says.
Yeah, that's true.
And Scorsese is everyone's idol if you're someone who wants to be a director, I suppose. But yeah, Todd Phillips. Who was the other nominee?
It was Tarantino, Todd Phillips, Bong.
Bong, Scorsese, and...
And it wasn't...
We don't know. Oh, we can't even remember.
It wasn't Baumbach.
It should have
been Gerwig.
We can't even remember the fifth nominee.
Irishman.
No,
we said Irishman.
Scorsese, Bong, Tarantino,
Mendes.
Todd Phillips.
Mendes.
Right, Mendes. Yeah. Now, of course, I forgot Mendes.
Yeah.
But yeah, like compared to those other names of Tarantino and Scorsese, Mendes, like who's a massive cinephile is like, I just love Sam Mendes.
Yeah, I know. You know? I agree. And
I'm sorry, Redemption is an underappreciated masterpiece.
I know. I'm not saying that Mendes is a bad director. I haven't seen it in long enough to say whether or not Road to Perdition is a masterpiece, but...
It's my favorite of his films.
But no, I like a lot of his films. I'm just saying that like he doesn't have that kind of legendary aura around him.
It was interesting...
That, like, Tarantino sort of has now.
It's interesting, though, that when we talk about things changing, this Martin Scorsese's film, The Irishman, was the only Best Picture nominee to walk away with no awards whatsoever. Eight of the other nine.
But he's had. I mean, I don't think it should be upon whether someone has won before or how many times they've won.
But it
there's a
to
feeling
people.
That I
it
agree.
Does.
But there's a. I think the reason is there's a feeling that he's had his dues and he's won so many times. Well, I don't think it's
he
a reason.
He won once.
For,
he hasn't
for
had
the
his
Departed.
Dues.
He's like worst
I'm,
film.
I'm,
well, not,
yeah, yeah, yeah. I agree.
One of his worst.
I'm
films.
With
much
you.
Better
it should
Departed.
Not.
Much
it should
better.
Never be based on how many times. And obviously, Deakins won the past couple of times for Blade Runner and now 1917. Turning to one of the other categories, my most frustrating was Best Adapted Screenplay. It went to Taika Waititi for Jojo Rabbit. It should have gone to Greta Gerwig for Little Women.
I agree.
Far superior.
I mean, I disagree. So this is a film fight club. So I'll argue for the man who won. But personally, I thought Jojo Rabbit, what was best about it was the screenplay in many ways. I thought, I know you guys aren't the biggest fans of it, but I did like it. I found it a touching film. Those moments of surprise that were in it, you know, with the shoes and such, I thought were really touching moments. And I liked Taika Waititi's speech.
Oh, I thought his speech was fantastic.
Which is great.
His press conference afterwards is the most hilarious, where he spends half it ranting about Apple keyboards versus PC keyboards.
When he, in his Oscar speech, when he spoke about the about his mother, there was some great line in there about, like, you know, thank you for being my mother and for many other things too. And no one laughed. And I thought that was really funny, just the way he said it. I loved his speech. Lots of nice wry humor, and I liked his call out to Indigenous storytellers.
Yeah.
So, I can't be angry about Waititi winning. I do like Waititi. I just don't like Jojo Rabbit that much.
For me, it was more that Gerwig enveloped in the source material for Little Women much more than I've seen in the adaptations. I haven't read Jojo Rabbit. I appreciate that
Caging
he diverted.
Skies, yeah.
Yes, we've heard very heavily from the source material, which he acknowledged in the press conference subsequently. However, with Little Women, I've read the books, I've seen the adaptation. Suddenly, I felt this is something dramatically new, very distinct from something like Emma, which we'll talk about later in
the
show.
Yeah, I was going to make that comparison as well. Little Women, I think, added something to the source material.
I agree.
Justified itself.
I agree. I also loved... I would have been very happy to see Little Women win as well.
Right.
But I'm still okay with Jojo Rabbit winning.
Fair.
A lot of American audiences...
Yes, welcome Virat Nehru, freelance critic.
Yay!
Hello.
Yeah, well, it's a great time to be talking about Little Women. Well, no, just the movie, not just generally. But, you know... A lot of American audiences, from what I've heard from film Twitter, were just very confused about the timeline.
It was as in of,
stupid.
Of Little Women?
Of Little Women, yeah. They were this is unnecessarily complicated.
It's I think not. It kind of is. You just need to, and it is initially, then you're like, oh, it's color coded.
Maybe
okay,
we should
fine.
Let the Little Women
And the
women
hairstyles,
on
the costuming,
speak.
Things are different. But it's not. It's subtle, yet not subtle enough that it works.
I think without the color coding, you'd be thrown. I mean you as in the general. I don't know about Glenn Falkenstein specifically, but I
appreciate that did help.
I think
you're
probably right, but I think that worked well for me. And personally, I liked it because it felt fresh. Like it was different from the other. There's been, I think, eight
yeah, it
Little
was,
Women
I,
movies
it,
made.
I think
there
was it
was nothing
an
the nuance
to
the performances that it signaled several years apart.
Give it a reason for existing. Like, why remake it again for another time?
I was just not like pretty crash hot for this category. I think it was just pretty mad, to be honest.
That's
I mean,
screenplay.
Yeah, adapted screenplay was just one of the weaker ones, unfortunately. Like, I just couldn't get behind any of the... Like, you know, it wasn't something...
Original screenplay was more interesting.
Oh, yeah.
Honestly, that was The Irishman...
Adapted, yeah.
Yeah, adapted. Yeah.
I would have given it to that.
Yeah, yeah.
Such a good script.
I had put that down in my wish list before.
Yeah. But Irishman or Little Women, I think, honestly, between those two...
I'm turning to the acting categories, the non-surprises of the night. I think it went as we'd all thought. I think Driver was robbed most of all. We were, however, treated to Joaquin Phoenix's very long speech on a number of matters ancillary to acting in Hollywood.
It's an entertaining speech. It was long-winded.
Are we talking about Joaquin Phoenix's speech?
Yeah, I
don't think it was very good at all.
I don't either. I say entertaining because it's always like, okay, this is different and unusual and I'm kind of confused.
Because everyone wants to hear an Oscar speech about artificial insemination of cows.
Yeah.
There's always one every year.
But Renee Zellweger also gave a pretty bad speech. Also very wafty and didn't really
They were both long-winded.
Yeah. And I mean, they were locks.
Guys,
they won every award.
We live in a society. It's
Plan
okay.
your speech.
The thing about Joaquin...
I disagree. Okay. The Renee Zellweger speech was actually focused on Judy Garland's legacy, the film itself, what the film told.
She could have said that a lot tighter. She
Agreed,
didn't.
But like, it wasn't the tangent that Joaquin Phoenix went on.
Look, both of them made
are great
good
actors,
points.
But terrible writers.
Well, no, because Joaquin Phoenix gave a really good BAFTA speech. Renee Zellweger gave a pretty good Golden Globe speech. These people can give good speeches.
Maybe
they just
ran out of material, and that happens sometimes.
Possible.
You know, because after you won, you know, and I think that's part of the problem.
Yeah, I mean, they won every single award.
Oscar
so
season kind of thing, you know, where you kind of get. Used to winning and you're like, oh, okay, you know, I have to give another speech now.
I need to make a speech about something that matters. Look, I'm never one to tell celebrities don't get political, keep your mouth shut, just, you know, shut up and entertain.
But it wasn't even that political,
I'm,
to be honest.
I'm not that person.
Well,
but it still felt
George Clooney
like too much.
I'm
like,
very happy with them to getting political.
Me too.
Because both of them were in the Golden Globe
Phoenix's
and BAFTA speech.
And I appreciated Phoenix's Golden Globe speech to that effect.
He got up and...
BAFTA.
Honestly, the Golden Globes too, where we talked specifically about Australia.
It was so
Joaquin
kind of...
Phoenix?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Joaquin, yeah, his speech was so kind of wafty and rambly from topic to topic that it just felt unfocused and self-indulgent to me.
Yeah.
But I could... By the end, I believe that he was... I think... Honestly, he just looked up there. He looked like he was very fragile for whatever reason at this state.
Oh, I agree. He was very moved because I think he was thinking of River, his brother.
He clearly was at the end, and he
was
choking. He
was
struggling to hold it together at the end.
But I think he tried to make 12 points and should have just focused on one.
Yeah.
Two at the most.
Yeah.
Like
just didn't
joke in the movie.
Yeah. Well,
debating 101 by Louise.
He just didn't seem like he was like focused and together. He seemed like he was in a bit of a fragile messy state mentally.
Yeah, yeah. But, yeah, that's probably true.
But I don't begrudge his win or his speech at the end of the day.
No, I do.
Well, I do actually. Antonio
Banderas should have won.
Adam Driver
should have won. I don't begrudge his speech. Antonio Banderas should have won after that.
I would, yeah, I do begrudge his win.
Adam Driver did not give a better performance.
I love Joaquin Phoenix as an actor, right?
He should have won if you were never really here doing a similar.
The Master. The Master. Definitely The Master.
Yeah.
Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Similar performance in The Master as well, right? Yeah. You know, an unhinged guy who goes into weird laughing fits and violent spasms. But.
Yes, guys, The Master is a movie.
I'm with you, Glenn, actually. Adam Driver and Antonio Banderas would have been better wins.
No, I think Scarlett Johansson was better in Marriage Story than Adam Driver was.
I thought they were both great.
I thought they were both very good.
I don't think
that the one was a better performer. I think that Adam Driver had the meatier material and got to work with much better. He had the more emphatic... Scarlett Johansson had very emotional scenes, but he had the really emotional-driven powerhouse scenes that Baumbach wanted to shove through to the Academy.
How great is it that Laura Dern finally has an Oscar?
It's great.
And she gave a great performance in Marriage
Story. Ever, though. She sleepwalked through that one.
I thought she was great in Marriage Story.
And she was better in Marriage Story than in Little Women.
I agree with that. I thought her role in Marriage Story was quite good, but I agree it wasn't the best of the supporting actor nominees. Yeah. Actress nominees.
I mean, Scarlett Johansson
but
was
yeah,
better
she did sleepwalk, but she didn't have to. She had to because everyone wanted to reward her for being just Hollywood's darling and for missing out twice.
and that she's having a really great resurgence in her career at the moment.
Absolutely.
I'm not a big fan of like people are owed, so they should now give them an Oscar for like a shitty performance.
But yeah, but it's not a shitty performance. It's a good performance.
She's exceptional. Of the three lawyers,
she really stood out in the film.
She was like, she did. She was empathetic. And remember these sequences where we talked about on the phone, several more, where it seems like she's the bad person. She's actually in a very empathetic, very caring role. Hmm. And it takes a performer of Laura Dern's caliber to get that across, and she does very well.
When you watched that scene, did you lose yourself in the moment?
I lost myself in a lot of moments.
Never let it go.
Yeah. Oh dear. We turned to the second worst
moment
of the
night. Why is everyone so upset about Eminem being there?
Because it made no sense.
First of all, Eminem's not that great. And why?
I mean, I'm not going to argue on that.
Also, because in a year when everyone's going on about Oscars so white, why pick the only white rapper to do a performance that has nothing to do with any of the films?
What about Adam
Merkin this year?
They probably thought Eminem is having a...
Actually, I would have loved that.
I would have loved Body to win Best Picture, but we don't live in that universe.
I wish we did, but yes, at least...
Body is way better than Green Book.
Oh, yeah, dude. Buddy was better than most of the Best Picture nominees this year. Or at least like a few, at least
no,
a few of them.
Last year.
I'd say it's better than
seven of the Best Picture nominees this year.
Yeah, that's probably right.
Bodied?
My highest rate of the Parasite and Marriage Story, but after that, I think Bodied was marginally better than Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, I'll say it.
For me, I don't think it's better than...
1917, no.
Let's not get it. This will take a while of thinking. Let's not get into it. But it's better than a bunch of them.
Top half.
Go watch Body again, guys. Hot take.
But the best musical performance of the night was obviously Elton John, who was great to see. And he won.
He actually performed really well.
And he did fine.
He and Birdie finally got an Oscar.
But yeah. He sings really well.
Because again, another thing that was just locked up from the beginning. It was boring. We all knew it was going to come.
The Oscars was mostly boring.
The best performance of the night was Cynthia the stand-up, I thought. From the film Harriet.
I'm going to be totally honest here. I tuned in late to the Oscars because it's the Oscars, and I just wanted to see.
You should
the
actually
final
watch
numbers.
That performance.
Okay, I watched most of it, but I missed the part where Eminem performs, which is why I don't understand. I was just like, I just heard Eminem was there, and everyone's angry about it. And I thought, did they do like a retrospective of past winners or something? Like,
No, what they did was they had Lin-Manuel Miranda, who would have been a much better performer to have on the show, introduce how important songs are in films. There's a montage of different songs in films. And then Eminem comes out and performs Lose Yourself.
The song he won 18 years ago?
Which made no sense.
It just randomly is Eminem. Well, that's funny.
Because he never performed 18 years ago. Suddenly, now it's your time.
Like, if it was a mashup, it would have kind of worked. Like, if it was a mashup of different...
Do you remember he didn't perform because it was like Prince... Prince Philip doesn't want him there or something like that. Some prince. I can't remember.
Something strange.
It was seriously that. It was someone's in the audience who's like, I won't be in the same room as that foul-mouthed ruffian.
Eminem, it's not happening. That Oscar winner, Eminem. No.
Yeah, it was and one then of, they gave it to him.
Yeah, I did see the performance in the end. Look, the Oscars...
The other performance I thought was really good was the opening by Janelle Monáe. It's had mixed reviews.
What a performer.
Yeah.
She's
it's
amazing.
It's had mixed reviews, but I loved it. I thought it was great. She, frankly, should have been hosting the Oscars.
Sing her heart out, yeah. To sing her heart out while dancing like that?
Yeah.
What an amazing performer.
It was incredible. And, you know, she managed to get, you know, pretty much the most grumpiest people in the world to actually get up and sing along and dance a little bit. So, yeah.
Guys, okay. Think about this. Eminem has won an Oscar and Glenn Close has not.
Bong has won an Oscar, and that makes me happy.
No, but do you think Eminem was owed?
No,
no, I don't. Not for Lose Yourself, not at all. Turning to the non-hosts, that was kind of frustrating. I love it. Was a bit of quite funny when George Mackay threw shade at the fact that George Mackay had to pivot to
introduce
Olivia
someone
Colman
else.
To introduce someone else who introduced the award. It was just a weird
instead of just
setup.
Having people announcing the person who'll come out who'll announce the award, they should just have the person come out and say, I'm here to announce best.
Yeah.
Best yeah,
picture,
and it would,
whatever.
And if they're so desperate to cut down the running time,
you'd
just
be like,
do
I'm
that.
Here announcing
exactly.
myself.
You know what I'm not a fan of? How they didn't show the clips of the Governor's Award. Lifetime Achievement is meaning less and less. First, they cut Lifetime Achievement Awards from the ceremony, so now they give out 3 awards, and in previous years they've shown clips at the separate ceremony where those awards are given out. This year they just announced these people won an award. Mm. And like, it's actually a nice moment to see someone get up and win Lifetime Achievement. I don't like how they're depriving us of that unless you seek it out on YouTube.
No, I think you're right. And to cut that and add these random hosts, like introducers of introducers.
Yeah, that would make way more sense.
If you saw the ceremony, you might be, you know, mistaken to think that Scorsese won a Lifetime Award because when
everyone
Bong mentioned him, everyone kind of stood up and like, oh, yeah.
Maybe
you're
thinking this might not ever happen again, that Scorsese has this big Oscar movie. I mean, it might, but
he'll
it might.
Something.
He probably will,
else.
But
oh, yeah,
it might not.
He's
you know?
Marty now, actually, so yeah, it's
you
actually,
never
we're on first name basis. Like we go way back.
Oh, yeah. So, nice.
I think final point in the Oscars, the worst moment of the night for me, and it's a, I think, more classless moment than people are giving it discredit for, the moment where James Corden and Rebel Wilson came out on stage dressed as the Cats.
I thought that was fine.
No, I wasn't okay with it. And yes, it's funny to say as Cats, they were presenting best visual effects. As being in the movie Cats, we understand the importance of good visual effects. And a lot of the visual effects advocacy groups have come out a very strong criticism of this instance because it's true. Yes, there were problems with the visual effects, but overwhelmingly, that wasn't the issue with Cats. And it's scapegoating the real problem, which was a lot of bad performances, including theirs, and bad conception and design, which was overly due not to the visual effects artists, but Tom Hooper and the people who had the idea of bringing this terrible musical to life. And that's moreover that. It was just a bad story and a bad musical.
You're missing the point. The people who had to receive an Oscar had to receive the Oscar with these two dressed as Cats. That is embarrassing.
No, it's awesome.
No,
I would
not be want to be up on stage and have
that.
I would once
not,
in my lifetime.
Also, I would not
moment.
Want to be a visual effects artist getting an award after that introduction.
Yeah.
I would, because like I mean, look, I personally felt it was just sort of self-referential, and you know, realizing
you're not winning an Oscar yet.
You're
never
going to
win an Oscar.
No, whoa.
Never say never.
It wasn't saying that they're never going to... I don't think it was pointed at themselves. They're perfectly fine at the visual effects of it.
You might write an adapted screenplay.
Yeah, you never know.
Not an original one.
No. He was saying the Cats.
I'm saying James Corden.
James Corden will never win an Oscar. Yeah.
No, all 4 of us are winning Oscars. Don't you worry. We're going to produce something.
Look, here's a thought. The Writers Guild have to nominate someone to get nominated for the screenplay. And James Corden's a guy who's gone out in Writers Guild of America meetings to say that writers should be paid less to keep the budget down on his show. James Corden is never going to be nominated for an Oscar. Roll out that adapted screenplay nomination.
Terrible sketches and terrible movies.
Yes,
including Cats.
But
also,
you know,
he doesn't even sing that well. I don't know what the point of him.
No one does.
No one does. So the last point I wanted to make was shout out to Fight Club with Sigourney Weaver and Brie Larson. And Gad Gadot saying they were going to start. A Fight Club.
That was probably the funniest joke of the night.
But I, but that whole segment, that whole segment.
I'm pretty sure she was talking about our radio shows.
Yeah, yeah. Of course, she was. Everyone in Hollywood is a big fan and regular listener. But actually,
yeah, QT.
I thought that moment was so stupid. It's like, okay, we're being criticized. Not the Fight Club, but specifically. All right, the Oscars are being criticized because no women were nominated for Best Director. I would say the only person who really had a shot in terms of making an Oscar-y movie that got off the ground was Greta Gerwig, and she did better than her work for Lady Bird. So, yeah, she should have been nominated. But to then, it's like the overcompensation by coming out and saying all women are superheroes, like superheroes who don't get nominated for Oscars.
Yeah,
like,
I mean,
also, what does that even mean? Like, no, not all women are superheroes, you know?
I mean,
like,
I agree that
this is a dumb platitude.
That line was a bit on the nose, but. You know, it's
like we're feminists.
Well,
we
no, but
just
it
didn't nominate any women for Best Director.
Women who have acted in roles where they're superheroes.
No, but they came out and said, "Oh, right, okay,
yeah.
All women are superheroes."
Fight. Yeah,
but also just generally, I mean, the other Oscar for Joker did go to a woman,
and
so
that was the best speech of the night, aside from a director bomb speech. I would say it was lovely and. Kind and generous.
Which speech is it, sorry?
Or best original score for Joker.
Yeah. And she did great work. Arguably the best thing about the film is her music.
I agree.
Yeah.
So that is our Oscars coverage. We're happier with it this year than we are in other years.
No, actually, I'm just genuinely
now
surprised.
I will drink till morning.
Yes,
but then
we've been drinking till morning.
But this means next year it's going to be all a shit fest again.
Probably. Look, I am happy that Parasite won, but I'm not overjoyed. I just can't care that much about the Oscars anymore. I thought, oh, this is kind of historic. And like, it's a good movie, one of the best of the year. Easily.
Come on.
One. That's cool.
Spikely
thing. But like, I've reached the point where it just doesn't matter to my life anymore.
I'm glad I tuned in at like very late in the piece.
Does that make sense?
I think it affects your life not at all. I don't think it ever has.
Oh, no. But in terms of like getting some satisfaction and caring about the Oscars.
I love it. I love the Oscars.
I care so much.
And I can say this because Louise and I have watched Oscar ceremonies. We had a party at our house to watch the Oscar ceremony when Hurt Locker won. That's how long we've been watching the Oscars.
Yeah. Oh, I've been, longer
I've been watching
than
it
that.
Before.
But yeah. But together.
Yeah, that was a terrible film.
But I feel like Glenn has to know what
Oscars.
I'm talking about. You said last year you were like, I didn't even watch. This year you tuned in really late.
2 hours late. There's a genuine apathy.
I've just reached a point of like, yeah, whatever. And it's like, oh, Parasite won. That's cool. I wonder how that'll affect this, you know, in the future. It won't. It's not going to happen again. It might, but
I hope it's a tie. But the thing is, we do.
Parasite
is
like
Oscars.
A rare crossover
the
movie.
The voters are changing. The base of the Academy has changed. We know this. It may be reflecting in future voting choices. We hope.
No, they were just guilty.
But the thing
that
is,
they gave it to Green Book.
Parasite is the only movie, foreign language film that was nominated of a field of 10, and none of the actors were nominated. I don't think this is going to happen again soon.
I mean, look, but the reason none of the actors... So, look, there's a big problem, which is they get the... So, how nominations get chosen is they're given a blank piece of paper and you're told to write in the names of who you thought was best that year. And nobody can remember, if you're an American person, the names of all those Korean actors in that film.
Yeah.
And it was the same, I think, with Lulu Wang and The Farewell. It's why a lot of foreign films...
Lulu Wang is like... They and Barry Jenkins are a power couple. Everyone knows them. What are you talking about?
The thing about the...
Yeah, but they weren't nominated this year. And no, but I'm saying the actors in her film.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, a lot of people said not only should The Farewell have been nominated for director in Best Picture, but...
Awkwafina. Everyone knows Awkwafina.
Yeah, but not enough to put a name on a blank piece of paper when you can only name five people.
I can forget Emma Stone, but
general,
I can't forget Awkwafina.
No, but I'm not talking about you. I'm talking about...
White people.
I think
white
in
people.
General, the
yeah,
Oscars,
people
are saying like Farewell was snubbed. I never thought it really had a chance. The thing is, the Oscars don't
what
like
do
quiet movies.
No.
Lady Bird was able to get in because Greta Gerwig was
marriage
connected.
Story, Marriage Story is a quiet film.
Because
yet it wasn't able to get in for Best Director because compared to the Best Director nominees, it wasn't loud enough.
Yeah, okay.
Farewell is quite restrained.
That's true, but there's usually a couple of quiet films that get Best Picture nominations.
Yes.
Always. Every
And I would argue
but
Marriage Story
Farewell
was...
is very quiet compared to what normally gets in, I would say.
No, I would say there's always at least a quiet film.
As quiet as The Farewell? I think like The Farewell is like
I think
indie,
you're thinking of
indie
a quiet
restrained
place.
How about the winner, Moonlight, not so long ago, which was a very quiet film?
Moonlight was pretty loud.
And that was in a year where
like
the Oscars wanted to show
drug dealers
that we cared
and
about
like
social
a guy's
justice
head getting slammed
and equality.
There were a lot of reflecting scenes and
it's
shots
true.
Of beaches and skies. And
yeah, but I think it had some kind of like impact behind it. But anyway.
Well, yeah, but I think The Farewell did too. That's neither here nor there.
So time for farewell.
Yeah, time for a farewell, because we're almost out of time. We're going to continue on the podcast with our discussion of Emma, which is in cinemas tomorrow. So you can tune in on iTunes
and Uncut
and
Gems, which is going to be the best part of the show.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Tune into the which uncut another, version of our podcast.
Another film snubbed at the Oscars.
Adam Sandler for Best Actor.
No.
We're also covering
Let's fight about it.
Yeah.
We will be, as we do tune in. We're also covering True History of the Kelly Gang and What Did Jack Do, the new shot from David Lynch. And please tune in next week, because we'll be chatting with Felix Hubble from Static Vision, who's running the Hyperlinks Festival next weekend from the 19th to the 21st at Pink Flamingo Cinemas over in America. We'll be there throughout the weekend. It's going to be a lot of fun. So this has been Glenn Falkenstein, Chris Evans, and Brett Nehru. I'd like to thank Louise Easton for joining us. Louise, to continue joining us into the podcast talking all things movies.
Thanks for having me, guys.
So stay tuned for the Sonic Assassin in a few minutes. Have a wonderful night. Enjoy movies. Enjoy the recaps of the Oscars if you're watching. And good night.
Long live Bong.
And we're back on Film Fight Club. Glenn Falkenstein, Chris Evans, Virat Nehru, and Louise Easton. We're starting with Emma going into What Did Jack Do? The True History of the Kelly Gang. And then our favorite of the day, possibly of the year so far, Uncut Gems.
Without a doubt, favorite of the year so far for me.
For me, it's That and Little Women.
Okay.
They were my two favorites. But we are talking about Emma, period. Emma dot. I'm not sure, because there is a dot in the title.
We're talking about Emma.
Full stop.
Emma full stop.
New sentence.
Emma new sentence. It is the new adaptation of the classic Austen novel starring Anya Taylor-Joy as Emma. It has Bill Nighy, Josh O'Connor, who plays Prince Charles in The Crown, Gemma Whelan, who plays Yara in Game of Thrones, and a number of others. It is the classic story which you have seen adapted any number of times, whether it be Clueless or else, about a young woman who spurns the idea of marriage and tradition, but is more interested in setting up her friends and those in society, and things obviously spiral from there. It is set in the early 19th century in merry old England, beset by the Napoleonic Wars, but you wouldn't know that from reading any Jane Austen novels. And yeah, so Emma, it is in cinemas tomorrow. Louise, what do we think?
Look, I thought it was not a bad film. I quite enjoyed it. I thought it was delightful, I think is the word I would use. It's, it's sort of, Emma is a film that has been done. There have been many different versions of this film made
And
before.
Here is another.
And here is another. Does it need to exist? I'm not sure. There are some positive things I have to say about it. There is one scene in the film. I won't give any spoilers.
It's spoiler-free. What's spoiling, Emma, even though you should have read it by now?
Or
at least seen Clueless.
No, Clueless.
Come on.
Yeah, or at least seen Clueless.
It's not good. Can I finally talk about Clueless on the show? It's not a good
Clueless
adaptation.
Is okay. Clueless, Clueless is fine. Clueless is good. Yeah. Clueless is fine.
Clueless
well,
is a great movie.
The consequence of the original
You're
adaptation,
wrong.
It's never been good. The only good thing about it was Paul Rudd. The idea of teenagers in modern America doesn't at all translate to the particular constraints for Emma.
I thought it did. I totally
But talking to this Emma...
Louise runs a book club, I think I would concur.
Yeah.
Have we ever covered Emma?
We haven't yet, actually.
But we've covered Clueless.
We have not covered Clueless either, which is only a film.
We've covered Clueless now. Don't see it. Don't teach it in high school.
No, it's great. I loved doing
it
in
Clueless,
high school. Anyway,
Clueless is great.
Okay, so this Emma, what I liked about it was I never really quite understood in any of the adaptations of the films that I've seen, nor in the book itself, really, why she ends up with the man she ends up with.
Because
so
he's a man.
I won't say who it is, but there are many men in the book. Yeah. She ends up with one of them, and I never really quite understood why. And I felt this job did a really good job of showing that. There is a scene in the film where they dance together, and I thought it was really well done, beautifully shot. And that scene alone, I think, makes the film worth seeing.
For me, that's the moment where the film started to work. For me, I was just kind of checked out until that moment about halfway through.
Yeah, and then you see them in that moment just fall in love with each other. And I thought that was just such a beautifully directed scene.
I agree, yeah.
And, you know,
love is not real, guys.
okay. And also, I would like to say that I really quite liked the costumes as well. I thought they were delicious.
It was great costuming.
Did you guys, I'm guessing it's only going to be me, but did the kind of Wes Anderson-ish production design and some of the delivery of the humor just kind of add to this kind of self-satisfied, like, oh, it's delightful.
It made me think a lot of Wes Anderson.
Yeah.
In the way.
Kind of feel like I just definitely. That some of the decisions of how this film has been directed just sort
but
of
I enjoyed
didn't work
that.
That well for me.
Well, I kind of enjoyed that kind of humor. I like Wes Anderson, so I liked
I do
how
too.
It brought out a bit of the humor of the novel Emma.
It all has this kind of pastel.
Yes.
Production design.
Yeah.
It's very, yeah.
Yeah, very much so.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I don't, however, think there was anything so distinct about directing on your further to your earlier point that that created this or rendered this distinct from any other Emma adaptation. What I liked in a similar vein, or I think what this was going for, was the Jane Austen novella adaptation from a few years back, Love and Mercy, with Kate Beckinsale, where it was a relatively new story, which we weren't so familiar with, but had a bit of a kitschy, out there vibe. And that, I think, went in more, was more committal in that regard, so it came out better. This didn't. I think the performances do elevate it. I really like Anya Taylor-Joy. Bill Nye has the ability, unlike or near anyone else, to just walk into a room and say anything and be outstandingly hilarious. Anya Taylor-Joy can do that too, but she gets a lot more dramatic material. And that dance scene, it reminded me, I loved it, it reminded me of the moment in the Pride and Prejudice BBC miniseries, still the hallmark of Austen adaptations, which was a similar action-orientated dance sequence where suddenly I understood the dynamics between the characters. It wasn't just two people talking in a room. There was movement. There was kineticism. And that was a high point in the movie. There were many others for me, but I do think that this was... Just a film. I think you said it right. It's a film. We've seen it.
What's the name? I felt the same. It felt very unnecessary.
But it's charming.
Did you say Love and Mercy? Because I think it's Love and Friendship, right?
No,
it's
Friendship. Sorry. Love and Mercy, excuse me, is the Paul Dano film about Brian Wilson.
Yeah.
Excuse me. Love and Friendship.
And I still think it has the best titles.
Love and
the opening titles are the most hilarious things I've ever seen.
The thing about... Yeah, well, sorry, what's the male lead's name?
Johnny Flynn?
Flynn.
There's Callum Turner and Johnny Flynn, is that it?
Yeah, I thought
he's a bit of a rattle.
He was good. He had this kind of gruffness.
No, I disagree.
It was a strange contrast with Anya Taylor-Joy as Emma.
But none of the male actors in this film had near the level of talent or charisma to match hers. And this was
you're just biased. You just love her.
What? That's outrageous. It's outrageous. you haven't seen the movie.
Yeah, that's true. You're right.
You haven't seen,
like, no, but I know you love Anya Taylor-Joy.
Wow. Okay. Wow. So there's no performer in this film, save Bill Nye, who has the ability to measure up to her in terms of her screen presence. It's that simple. I agree. I don't like Clueless, but I agree that Alicia Silverstone was the best thing about it. Paul Rudd was great in that role, and he matched her for talent and charisma. And you know what? You cast Paul Rudd in this movie now, it probably would have been better than casting one of these two schmucks.
Look,
schmucks. Wow. Okay.
not schmucks,
I thought their
performances
were fine.
They were serviceable at best.
Glenn
has strong feelings about this.
Yeah, I thought they were fine. I never thought for a moment, oh, how they don't match up to her. But I mean, yeah, she was particularly good, but that's what you would expect in a film called Emma. Full stop.
She was the best.
She needs to be the point of the whole film. It's about her. That's why we're watching it.
Yeah, I wonder who this is for, because it's not just
people
that we've seen...
People who really like Jane Austen. But
the grandmas who make up most of the art house audience.
But it's not just that we've seen...
People like our age as well, like that mostly
I know, but,
female,
but
who
I was
love
just,
Jane Austen.
I know there are Austen fans of every demographic, but I was just watching this, imagining all the like dandy grannies with like the, you know, come for the tea and Amazon and like the...
I try like to
same as Judy. Like a lot of these movies are just made for this demographic.
But here's the thing. We not only have we seen so many Austen adaptations, I agree it isn't as many as in the mid-2000s when it was fever pitch after the Colin Firth, Jennifer L adaptation, but... with Emma in particular, we have to remember Emma was more popular than Pride and Prejudice before the BBC miniseries came out, and it is the basis for so many romances where it's a will they, won't they. A lot of it you can drill back to Emma, and you're adapting here the cornerstone of this genre, but you're not giving anything new to it. Why?
Yeah,
okay,
there's nothing different about it.
It just felt inessential.
It's like Flash Gordon when Flash Gordon came out.
Beyond having kind of fussy production design, that's the only thing that's really new.
Yeah. And I will give it to Josh O'Connor as Mr. Elton, the priest. He was quite funny. I like him as Prince Charles, but he was good in this.
Yeah, I agree, actually.
Yeah. So that is Emma. Yeah.
If you want to see a new film of Emma, here it is. Tomorrow.
It's a film.
I would recommend any fan of Jane Austen's to see it.
Or just go and read the book.
People who like...
You don't like the book?
I like it. It's not my favourite Austen.
Well, someone you have a favorite Mansfield Austen? Park,
of course,
please.
I have a favorite Austen. You don't have.
It's been a while since we had Mansfield, like 20 years.
They're all equally inconsequential.
It's a harder one to adapt, though.
Have you read them all?
Yeah.
Persuasion.
I'm.
Oh, yeah, actually, okay, that's
true. Yeah, come on.
I'm a classicalist, Thank Pride you. And Prejudice. I remember, this is going to sound very pretentious.
Pride and Prejudice is my second favourite.
I remember with great fondness my time in Bath, sitting in the Grove in summer, just having just been to the Jane Austen Centre and reading my red velvet covered copies. It was quite lovely.
Yeah, you do have kind of a, like a pretentious Mr. Darcy vibe sometimes.
It's called Mr. Darcy.
Oh, my God. That's
oh my God.
So sweet. I'm gonna go jump that's in the a, nicest thing you've ever said to Glenn.
I'm going to go jump in a fountain right now.
Yep. It's okay, because it's so near, I have to be nice to him.
So, that is Emma, full stop, starring apparently someone who I'm crazy about, Anya Taylor-Joy, which is in cinemas tomorrow. And
you know it, Glenn. Don't try to hide it. I can see it in your face, you're blushing.
But we're on radio, Dad. Rot. And next film we're talking about, very different change of tack, is What Did Jack Do? We're doing David Lynch.
Yeah, we want to cover this, apparently. I'm the David Lynch super fan here, so I guess I'll introduce it. David Lynch interrogates a monkey who has, he's a detective, and the monkey's been accused of murder. I don't have much to say about this movie.
It's 17 Lynch, minutes long.
Yeah, it's 17 minutes.
A lot
which
of monkey
is,
business.
Is long for what it is, but didn't feel super long, so I guess that shows that it was made fairly competently. I thought it was kind of amusing, and then it ended. That's
I,
it.
I think that that is a fair analysis of this film.
I don't.
It kind of reminded me, I mean, for me, it kind of reminded me of in when I was like studying film at film school, we were given a project where...
Cooler Shove Effect?
Maybe.
Where
I
they you cut to anything? Is that it? Or
you're given, you're basically all given the same dialogue that's just randomly ripped from different scripts.
Yeah.
And then you have to take these random dialogue lines and put together a film, and it reminded me of that. Like, these sounded like the, because the lines are sort of disjointed, they don't quite match up, they're sort of random.
Yeah, Lynch has done that before with Rabbits, which he later put in Inland Empire. Rabbits is a sitcom where rabbits are saying weirdly disconnected lines to each other in the living room.
3.5 hours from my life, I'll never get back.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So I wonder if that's how this was put together as well.
Yeah,
it's like
it
a Dadaist technique, I think, of just pulling, like the Dadaists used to do that, like make stories or plays from pulling a bunch of phrases and words out of a hat.
Right. Well, yeah. So that's pretty much what they got us to do at film school.
Yeah.
So it feels like that.
And a lot of this is like Lynch in his traditional delivery saying like cliched phrases, and they're being interpreted literally in this context by the monkey. And, yeah, it's kind of amusing.
Yeah.
I had more fun with this because, you know, kind of 5 minutes in, I started thinking about this other great detective movie that I saw called Detective Pikachu. And I was thinking if these two worlds somehow coexisted.
One of the great detective films of all time, surely.
You know, and I was thinking...
Imagine if it was David Lynch instead of the kid in that movie.
Actually...
With the monkey.
So this is exactly what
Detective
I was thinking.
Pikachu? Yes.
Right.
And I was like, you know, what if all these Pokemon somehow were in this universe and we go less, you know, interrogating.
So what you're saying is you made up your own entertainment while you watched this movie.
But the thing is, that's what Lynch encourages you, doesn't he?
He doesn't kind of want you to dream, but I don't know if he was thinking of dreaming of Detective Pikachu.
But those 17 minutes seemed a lot more fun when I was thinking about it.
It was fine. Do we have anything to say?
I thought it was fine.
I don't think it was. I think you've all just been trolled by David Lynch.
I thought so, yeah, too.
You've all just been trolled by David Lynch. David Lynch went to Netflix and said, all right, I have a bet with a friend that I can make anything, and
David Lynch fans will watch it. It totally is David Lynch trolling. I agree.
With a monkey.
I agree. It totally is just trolling. I was just kind, for whatever reason, maybe it's the weird special effect on the monkey and just how cute the monkey is. Yeah. I was just vaguely entertained by it. I'm not going to go and make any great claims
to this.
The
monkey was a very good performer as well. I would not him.
But here's the thing. Non-sequiturs, it's not even that they were non-sequiturs that didn't lead anywhere. It's that they weren't engaging in and of themselves. And while I don't like Lynch, he genuinely has a very fluid shooting style. I would refer to Blue Velvet and Elephant Man. It's still my favorite of his films. This was, except for the end, very static. Shot.
It's
boring when you're just watching a person and the monkey saying things that make no sense aren't involving.
I think he's trying to create this kind of hypnotic flow where it's just this phrase... And then the monkey's face, phrase, and then Lynch's... I think it's meant to be something that you kind of just tune out to, which is something more and more a direction Lynch has been moving
Trier. It's simple as that.
This would have worked as a 30-second thing where the reveal was, oh, it's a monkey. end credits. Actually, the one thing I did like, the one thing that was just over the top, ridiculous, insane, and fun, was the song. Otherwise,
but it
no,
came.
I'm
the
sorry.
Song I think came too late.
Way too late.
It could have been
3 minutes with a reveal of the monkey and then the song, and that would have been fine. I would have enjoyed a 3 minute.
I think
by David Lynch.
The overextended length was over. It's something Lynch has been playing with for a while, but I think this could have been 10 minutes. It would have been fine.
I agree.
The whole thing was an indulgence.
Well, yeah. It's just Lynch messing around.
We needed Laura Dern.
She would have added something.
Anything is better with Laura Dern. But she was too busy making better films, like Little Women.
Apparently, David Lynch wants to do a project with her where she shaves her head, like, completely bald.
Weird. Yeah. Did you guys see the Indie Spirit Awards?
I missed it.
That was nice.
The Gay Men's Choir did a song where they talk about all the things you might not have realized were queer in this year's nominees. And they just end with saying, Laura Dern, Laura Dern, for like a couple of minutes afterwards. Right. It's great.
Yeah, it went viral for good reason.
Laura Dern's great.
Yeah. I appreciate that the Indie Spirit Awards also acknowledged her significance within the queer and LGBT rights movement, given that after her appearance on the coming out episode of Ellen, she didn't get a prominent work for quite a while.
Ten years. Yeah. She wasn't able to get work.
So I'm glad that they acknowledged it. So we're going to be talking about the Indie Spirit Awards in a little more detail later when we talk about Uncut Gems.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, cool. Adam Sandler's great speech. That was the speech of the season, actually.
I'll have to look it up, shall we?
Oh, you've all lost to Adam Sandler. That's who you are now. The guys who lost to Adam Sandler.
He did actually say that.
Shall we press on?
The True History of the Kelly Gang.
The True History of the Kelly Gang, based on the novel by Peter Carey.
The Booker Prize winner.
Yeah.
So this is the adaptation of Justin Kurzel, the director of Macbeth, Snowtown, and Assassin's Creed.
Oh, Assassin's Creed. What a gem that was.
That was truly terrible. I wasn't a fan of Macbeth either.
I'm not that big a fan of anything he's made, actually.
No, neither. Not
even
this, really.
Snowtown?
I thought it was fine.
I haven't seen it.
It's like, you're either into this really grimy Australian bleak crime film subgenre or you're not. Mm-hmm. And I would not count myself among the fans.
But I thought that was already David Michaud.
They're the same kind of place that they're coming from, I think.
At least David Michaud. It's somewhat funnier.
It's this subgenre. It's definitely a movement in Australian cinema.
Yeah.
So it is this, but this one is starring George Mackay, Nicholas Holt, Thompson McKenzie, also from Jojo Rabbit and other better films.
Leave no trace.
Russell Crowe, Charlie Hunnam, and Essie Davis. It is the, as they say, the not true history of the Kelly Gang, the infamous outlaw. Importantly, Ned Kelly was the subject of the first ever film ever made, and there have been several adaptations of his story since. And this focuses on his early life and later time as a bushranger. It is streaming now on Stan. Mm,
the first ever feature-length film.
Feature-length film. I struggle with this because I actually took a trip through Victoria, rural Victoria, earlier this year, and I went to Glen Rowan. I've been before, and I spoke to a lot of people who had been substantially involved in the film, were historians who had covered this history, and they made the point, we have a really strange understanding of who and what Ned Kelly is. Some people lionize him as a Robin Hood. He wasn't. Some people refer to him from the immigrant perspective. Certainly this film goes in that direction. Others take the view that he was simply an outlaw and, quote-unquote, got what he deserved. And obviously the symbolism of Ned Kelly, problematically and sadly, has become associated in some respects in modern day with some quite extreme movements, which were not fans of, and the film takes great lengths to reject those sorts of ideas and is a riposte to that. Having said that, I don't think this film gave a really clear or new idea as to who or what Ned Kelly is or how I should be acknowledged or revered. Certainly the film tries to drive this home and ends very frustratingly on a speech, as many bad films do, which belays the moral of the story, and that was kind of emblematic to me of a lot of the problems with this.
I don't think this speech was relaying the moral.
Also, didn't Ned Kelly ever give a speech? I don't think he was
a speech kind of person. Ned Kelly.
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't think the... but yeah, I wouldn't say... I think we're meant to have a somewhat complicated relationship with the speech that ends the film. But we'd need to get into spoiler territory for me to discuss that more so.
Well, the other thing to remember with this film is, despite being called The True History of the Kelly Gang, it is an entirely fictionalized work by Peter Carey.
Although it draws a lot from the historical record. It's sort of a blend.
Yeah, but a lot of it he made up. Yes. The whole thing of the Son of Siv and all that made up.
Yeah.
It changes weird historical things that... The events surrounding the night at Glen Rowan, which are depicted in the film, they changed simply things that I don't know why you would change at what point are you trying to make Which I was surprised. I'm referring to the circumstances in which the police were able to track them down.
Yeah, I wondered about that too.
It's writers. If you're a writer, you have that kind of ego. You'd be like, oh, you know, I'm going to do it because I can.
Part of it depicted Kelly as being more unhinged than the actual historical record would necessarily. I mean, not to say that Ned Kelly wasn't unhinged, but I think they went out of their way to show him as unhinged and not thinking clearly in this version.
Also, it implies that he had a child. He's never had a child.
Yeah.
Another good point to make. For me, like the first half of the film, I was kind of into it, but then it kind of lost me partway through. I'm not sure where, but it did, and it didn't really work for me. I did like the song though, that Russell Crowe.
I did too.
I did love Russell Crowe.
Not wanting to spoil it, but
Crowe was good. Yeah,
yeah. I thought Crowe did a really good performance in it. Actually,
yeah.
That was a highlight for me.
Charlie Hunnam was great. Yeah. Thomas McKenzie was good. Everyone, she didn't get enough to do, but yeah. Neither did Charlie Hunnam. Nor did Nicholas Hoult. Really, all the performers are good in this.
Yeah,
and actually, the best
George MacKay was good.
They're all good.
Everyone's good. Yeah.
The best scene for me though was the Charlie Hunnam scene early in the film. Was one really tense sequence in a hotel room. Where I won't describe what happens, but it was very like, oh, I'm on the edge of my seat here. What's going on?
I agree. I had actually a lot of sympathy for Hunnam's character here. He didn't come across as the terrible person that they were painting him as necessarily.
I don't agree with you.
Right. I don't.
I'm with Louise on this one.
I wouldn't say he's a nice person, but like, was he really victimizing this family?
I think it's heavily implied at the beginning, enough that it's. It was clear enough for me that...
Actually, you're right.
Yes.
I retract my statements.
Good.
A broad comment on this film. This is not a criticism of the film, nor any comment on the City Theatre scene itself, but this felt to me like a high-budget production, one of the more high-budget productions that Belvoir do in terms of its staging, particularly the end scene where...
Yeah, it did feel very stagey.
Yeah, the lighting.
Which is weird.
Strobe lights.
Yeah.
I was watching
a stage production.
I wondered why they went with this...
I didn't like it.
I wonder why they went with this strobe light choice.
It's fine. I don't know. It didn't... Well, yeah, it didn't work for me.
And with the figures on the hill, I mean, it's fine with the artifice of theatre where you can suspend disbelief, but in the film, it's, oh, why didn't you just film people coming at you across an embankment? It feels like I'm watching a bit of not a puppet show, but something put on. And why do we need this? The reason we have cinema, the reason is that we can see more quote-unquote realistic environments, and that took me out of the film. It took me out of those consequential scene, which is the Glen Rowan siege, which has been... lionized and debated and discussed, which a substantial amount of the film is devoted to.
I think it just wasn't that well put together. Kurzel has tried to make it dynamic with like the snorri cam shots on Kelly's helmet, and the did it feel like he was painting the police as KKK sort of figures, the white cloaks.
I wondered if that was
intended. It feels like
I didn't get that from it. I'm not saying it's not necessarily what he was going for, but I just didn't get that.
I wondered if it was meant to be that. It's like we're being victimized for our race by these English coppers. Here's all these white cloaked people shooting. I don't know.
That's an interesting perspective. I hadn't considered it.
I think it was definitely the immigrant angle that it was going for. We want to treat him as a sympathetic character, but also know that this is someone who did terrible things in the course of what he saw as justice or revenge or righting wrongs.
Right.
And I don't think he wanted to go so far as to draw that sort of symbolism. I'm just going off some of the other trajectories throughout.
Yeah, it was just something I sort of wondered because in actuality they're wearing black cloaks, but it could just be a production reason to make them stand out in the darkness so that we can follow the scene. But it is a little... You wonder when you see a line of white cloaked people with torches. You know?
As the only non-white person on the panel. And
not true, excuse me.
Ah, yeah, sorry. Well, as the only non-Australian person so far. Yeah?
Not true.
You're Australian.
We're not going to talk about anyone's background. Let's move
on. Okay, fine. Well, I didn't... Basically, the point is, I didn't know anything about Ned Kelly. And this is not a good film to be introduced to his folklore either.
You didn't know anything about Ned. Oh, okay.
Well, I did. But like, you know, as someone who wore a Tin Man. You know,
he was in The Wizard of Oz,
yeah,
okay,
famously.
Okay, okay.
That is as far as goes.
Well, no,
for me.
This is a completely fictionalized, made-up version.
Yeah. I know, about
but if you want to see a good film about Ned Kelly,
yes.
I recommend Ned.
I haven't seen that.
Okay.
I
thought you wanted to say something after that. You just said
no,
Ned.
That was it. There's a film called Ned. No, there's a film called Ned. It's a comedy. It's very,
what?
Very good.
You know,
it's a comedy about Ned Kelly, but it actually...
a comedy?
Yeah. I highly recommend it.
I remember liking the Heath Ledger version back in the day. I haven't seen the original, i.e. 1905 version, or the Rolling Stones, the Mick Jagger version, which from the 70s. But right, this was your first introduction to the mythology of Ned Kelly.
Well, no, I knew of him, but like peripherally. That's it. The only thing I knew was like he was an outlaw and he, you know, wore a tin mask and yeah, got shot. That's all I knew. These three things and that's it.
Interesting fact
You should see the Chris Lilley version called Ned.
Oh, yep.
It's very good.
Chris Lilley, oh god, okay.
And I recommend it.
Okay, so
Jermaine.
I felt like the transition between his reluctance to kill, be the murderer his mum wants him to be, through to being actually a completely brutal, savage person, was not that well handled. I think it still kind of happened a little bit too quickly, even with all of the time spent on the build up. Because he goes to a pretty crazy length by the end, right?
I actually thought it was weird, the interaction between him and his mum.
Yeah, it was strange.
Which, again, not wanting to spoil anything, but I don't know why they made that choice. I don't know, maybe it's in the book, but...
Yeah.
I agree. There's a nuance that could have been applied with more depth or a lengthier storytelling, but I feel they wanted to portray him both as an intelligent person, but a victim of manipulation and circumstance, and there is a way you can do both. But all too quickly, it's suddenly you're supposed to believe that this person, due to all these reasons, becomes this, but then still has the capability and intelligence and wherewithal amidst all this emotional, intellectual upheaval and else to pull all this off. And the film doesn't quite sell it in the way that I feel. It's not an exact comparison, but The Irishman shows a tragic figure in different circumstances, but shows their trajectory and thought process over a long time, and we get to it's 3.5 hours long, but we understand Frank's psyche. I wish we got a similar insight to Ned Kelly here.
Yeah, I think it kind of actually skirted over the bushranging period. There wasn't that much of that shown here, and I wonder if that's partly so as not to complicate audience identification with this guy, because you wonder when it's like, oh, the one part we'll skip over is the whole killing innocence bit. It's shown, but there's not that much screen time.
Ned Kelly did that a lot.
Yeah.
Interesting fact about...
Sure, but sort of the English to the Irish.
That's true. It's absolutely true.
That's true, but one, you know, one doesn't justify the other.
The British are portrayed as bad people.
Yes. I think... Sorry, what were you saying?
And the indigenous people before them, as the mum makes the point.
Yes.
If you want a better film that deals with these issues, go watch The Nightingale.
It was... Yes, it was.
Yes.
And it was a much better directed film. This film...
Oh, God, yes.
They're both covering this really bleak, hard, you know, to watch kind of territory. But this one felt less fresh to me. It felt a little bit cliched. And the result is the kind of drudginess, you know, that's hard to get through. I don't think it's a bad film. I think it's well performed enough.
Yeah, that, I agree.
It's decent.
It's better than the animatronic showing Glen Roan that's now showing the history of Ned Kelly. Fun fact, but they never rebuilt the hotel in the town. There's a hotel opposite, but the land of the Glen Roan Hotel is just a field now, just a piece of grass. We always have trouble reckoning. We always had a strange relationship with this area of history, and this envelops on it in some detail, and it is now streaming on Stan. The last film we are talking about this week is one of the most anticipated of the year, and certainly our most anticipated of the show, Uncut Gems, the new film from the Safdie brothers, who directed Good Time a couple of years back, a film we are and remain big fans of. It is starring Adam Sandler as Howard, Kevin Garnett, the real-life basketball player, Idina Menzel, Julia Fox in her debut role. You'll be seeing a lot more of her, and Lakeith Stanfield. It is about Howard, a gem dealer in New York, who comes across the deal of a lifetime when he finally gets his hands on a very expensive, very valuable uncut gem, and he wants to offload this and make a packet of money, and it's about the events that transpire in the coming period and some very tense encounters herein. I said earlier this is possibly my favorite film of the year so far. The anticipation and wait was well worth it. What did we think of Uncut Gems?
I think tense is an understatement. This was the most stressful film to watch. It was fantastic, but stressful as anything. I think the score helped with that a lot too, which was just great for kicking
brilliant
up.
Brilliant score, yeah. No Oscar nomination.
I know, again, crazy. Like, this film should have had several Oscar nominations.
It was too good to get nominated.
Do not
for the
be
Oscars.
Nominated for Best Original Screenplay.
And I say that in the Parasite.
I agree. I thought the screenplay was brilliant.
I think the reason why is that it's lacking the kind of positive, reassuring elements that the Academy like in their films.
The Academy tend to like sad films.
Yeah, but this film is about bad people for the most part. Or it's driven by a character who is a bad... You know, we can grow to like him in the way you can like a great noir protagonist, but who maybe does bad things, but you still hope they can make it through.
I think you could argue the same thing about Parasite.
You could argue the same thing about Parasite, but Parasite gives you, I think, more hope. Audience... gives you more hope.
And uplift.
And also, an uplift, and also gives you... More, I think Parasite has more audience-pleasing moments, like, oh, the family's together now, or...
And also, it's a clear rich versus poor thing, which just you can, you know, automatically sort of, like...
This is a rich versus poor thing, too, but in a much more buried kind of way, some, you know...
Yeah, metaphorical. Yeah, it's definitely got some things to say about class as well, as a lot of this year's Hollywood films do.
Yeah. There's also probably my favourite... turning to some of the actors, my favorite Adam Sandler performance to date. Kevin Garnett, the basketball player, is great in this. He's a little bit stulty, but he's...
I thought he was great. But Kevin Garnett was amazing.
I thought he was really good too.
Dramatic performance.
Yeah. Yeah. I honestly didn't even know he was a real basketball player before.
He's like 6'6".
How it uses real life celebrities. Like, we've also got The Weeknd.
Yes, exactly. The real Weeknd. I knew, and I was like, wow.
Yeah.
That was fantastic.
I remember in 2012 hearing buzz about him before he'd broken out as a big pop star.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they've captured that moment.
It's fantastic.
It's interesting.
Yeah.
You should note that it is filmed in and around New York to the extent that they didn't get permits for places, and they had to basically put a bunch of people around the actors and directors and cinematographers, and just so people wouldn't rock up and say, oh, that's Adam Sandler, let's get a photo. So it looked like they were filming in a genuine actor environment. It shows. It feels like... I've spent a lot of time in New York. It feels like you're on the streets there. And the actors feel real. The contributions feel real.
It's an unconventional film because it goes for the most part, sustained intensity through the whole thing. Because we're looking at a character who's got so much danger surrounding him, and he tries to bluster his way through everything.
He was just addicted to making terrible decisions.
He was addicted to living on that knife's edge.
That's actually my one criticism of the film. We're happy to get to that later, but the characterization I genuinely liked. It kept it... It was very tension-inducing. I think there were moments where the tension let up. I think Good Time was a more tightly plot. I still prefer Uncut Gems, but Good Time was more tightly plot to that extent where you don't feel there was a moment where you could breathe. And maybe, yes, Uncut Gems didn't need those moments because there were just moments, particularly in
this is a longer film
that
as
was
well.
So, oh my God, I can't believe that happened. I can't believe you did that. And maybe you needed that reprieve.
The thing is, he is an extreme character, and he makes choices that would be completely ridiculous to you or I, but I believed it in the context of this film.
Believed it. Yeah.
Yeah.
On that, because I was thinking about that, and I was like, you know, is it something in the script or is it something in Adam Sandler's performance? But actually, it is Sandler himself. And I think the Safdie brothers have been trying to cast him since 2009, when they originally had conceived this movie. And I can see why, because it's only when you see Sandler, who's so crazy in his sort of comedic avatar, that you can believe that he can make these bad choices in movies. Maybe Nicolas Cage only other alternative.
Sandler, in a much more believable way than Nicolas Cage has been lately, translates that kind of madness of his comic persona to this guy where he's always... You know, he's yelling in excitement, or he's sort of crying and banging his head against things. Like he is...
Because you can't separate Adam Sandler from... Even though this is actually a great character performance, but it's still Adam Sandler.
I was able to stop thinking about the comic persona.
He's a physical performer. Yeah. He is, he has been in all his comedies, and this really shows in this film as well.
Because he only does, like, one dramatic performance every 10 years, so, like, you know...
Yeah. He's done a couple of recent times.
I think Pirate Stories.
I think he made the character believable. The guy is scummy, and you might think, why does he have people like Julia Fox, who is so devoted to him and so loving around him? But you can see that he has this kind of magnetism. He has this charisma that he could convince people to keep giving him another chance, which is how he's able to get himself in these dangerous situations in the first place.
Or to make terrible movies and star in them.
This is my problem. He said that if he just doesn't do well, he'll make more terrible films. But this is my problem with it. And just on the matter of Julia Fox, she's outstanding in it. Every scene, she has an amazing future ahead of her as a performer. One thing that did get me about this is that he makes a lot of terrible decisions. Yes, I believe that he could make all these decisions. And in the beginning, I found myself rooting for this character because I came invested in the story. But for the reason that when, it's not so much that he could make terrible decisions, is that when he is offered opportunities or chances to get to change stuff, or get out, he makes the bad decision. And that makes him immediately much less sympathetic. As soon as he became less sympathetic, and more, this is more in the second half, I found it much harder to cheer for him, much harder to get behind him. This is a problem. It didn't detract greatly from the film. I still enjoyed it, but it took away from what is... I love the second half, but it wasn't on the level of involvement on the first half for that reason.
But do you
need to get behind your protagonist?
Yeah, I don't think you do.
There's two... Yeah, I agree with that. Okay. I think there's a car crash kind of quality to it where there's an enjoyment in watching him keep making
wreck,
the...
Yeah,
you're seeing a train wreck. You can't look away as he keeps making these terrible decisions. So I think there's entertainment value in that. So to some extent, it just did not matter that he was starting to make those bad decisions.
But
and
maybe
for me,
Glenn
I think,
is a likeable person.
I think there's just the intensity of the filmmaking meant that I stayed with it even as he was making those terrible decisions. And it got me into his head a little bit where even as I was thinking, man, this guy is so stupid.
Like, I wouldn't do
I
it,
still
but I can see why
was
he
on
would.
Edge and wanting
yeah.
to see
it
him
still made the ending
come out on top, hopefully.
Less.
I disagree.
I can't get into this
disagree.
Without the spoilers, but made the ending
no, I disagree.
Level.
I disagree
as well, because like, I mean, he was making bad decisions.
That was the
stupid
only thing
decisions
that, made,
that I would
made
never
sense.
Make from the beginning.
Yeah. That was the
from
only thing that made sense.
From his very first thing that he does.
But it's right to make one stupid decision or so many, but when it just becomes, it compounds itself. And it's not just that he made stupid decisions, it's that he was offered opportunities to extricate himself,
but
didn't. But that was
that's
the key
what
crux.
The film's really about, I think. It's about someone who doesn't value it, the same things as us. He just values being in that margin position where everything could collapse or he could come out on top at any moment.
It's an interesting thing because those decisions that the character makes, it's actually the screenplay is interesting like that because it feels like a compressed spring where you kind of keep
that.
Kind of like each action is compressing the spring and like in the end is the release and the only time you let go and you're like finally
thank God it ended
because it kind of felt like I don't know how many bad decisions this guy could have made otherwise because I just could not deal with it.
The screenplay is incredible because there's a lot of setup and payoff and many different balls in the air that are being juggled, but it still manages to maintain this intensity.
I felt very claustrophobic. Like, you know, it has a claustrophobic quality to it.
Absolutely, I agree.
How brilliant is this scene?
I don't think it managed to maintain the intensity. As I said before,
there
are periods of absolute reprieve where you stop and think, okay, going along is normal.
No.
Again, I
going
do
along
feel...
Is normal?
Again,
no, normal
again,
movie.
Again, I do feel that this may be for the simple reason that you're in this sort of film, in a longer period piece, you need the opportunity to breathe. But there were stretches of intensity inducing, oh my God, what is going on? And there are times when it was more relaxed kilter. I appreciate this was in a longer film. If it was 80 minutes, I would have just liked not ongoing, non-stop. But it didn't mind.
But it's
much.
Also to flesh out the character because I think a lot of the moments you're talking about that are like reprieve are times when he maybe spends some time with his family or spends some time with his mistress and he's...
But
know,
even there, he's made terrible choices.
And
I know, yes, even there, he makes
so
terrible choices.
I was anxious in every one of those scenes. Like, I've got a Fitbit, and my heart rate was going up so high while watching this film that it's
but
like,
that's the thing.
You're at fat-burning level.
Because it's not just, like, actual physical danger. It's also, like, this guy is just not got one thing right.
Yeah.
It
feels
like my favorite scene in the movie. It's one of the more quiet sequences. It's a Pesach Seder, where they're with the family. Also, a great twist in the sequence, which we won't reveal. But it's a very authentic moment where they're running around, they're looking for the Avakomen, and he's having this intense conversation with his wife, Idina Menzel. There's an amazing retort in it of all my lines in the film where she just, you know, hits him for sex.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
It really feels
so lived in, the family aspect of it, the jewelry store and the depiction of that world.
Well, the Safdie brothers grew up in that world.
I know, yes. But it feels real, and it's a film I enjoy watching because feels like I'm being shown something real. I think maybe the casting of the celebrities is to add to that feeling of this is the real world.
And they created those Furby blings especially for this film.
They did not exist before now.
They're so
funny. The Furby blings.
So great.
It's so great. Yeah. But this character is so interesting to me because I think that his character, his decisions, as you say, are so stupid and so consistent that it gets you to start questioning what's really driving this person. And for me, this might be a bit of a strange reaction, but for me, it was such an extreme character and such an extreme trajectory that it got me to sort of have thoughts like, what is the meaning of life? So, you know, like what is it all for? That all of these obstacles, nothing. Right? All these obstacles and all of this struggle, and what is it really for? Like, he's trying to prove himself, I think.
On that, I really appreciated not just the sports metaphor, but the analogy that this film draws between cinema itself, plotting, aspiration, and sports play. You see it like in a very broad sense narrated in a lot of movies, but here it's done very well. Here it's through the prism of basketball, and particularly as one basketball sequence plays out. I'm not a big basketball fan, but I don't think ever in my life have I seen a basketball film where I've been so engaged in a game. It's not just because of what the stakes for the characters, but it being very clearly enunciated how basketball measures in the mind for someone who may have a similar passion for the sport as I do for, say, film.
I really like basketball, and I felt that the film itself really encapsulated that feeling of being excited as a game, as you were sort of saying.
Right.
Particularly a close game.
Pinning everything on basketball or pinning anything or on a gem, it's all these kind of just meaningless symbols. Yeah. But I think for this character, it's all sort of started to become like, I put all my hope in this thing, and it's going to prove that I'm great. It's going to justify everything that's gone wrong previously.
But it's not just that, because the use of basketball as a sport is also important, because it's not just basketball. I mean, the way the sport plays into the metaphor of the film and the actual screenplay. Because, you know, Louise would know, being a basketball fan, there's a shot clock, right? Yeah. So we have to basically make your shot in 25 seconds. So there's already that kind of time-bound pressure in the game. And then the screenplay is set up like that, where you kind of feel like you're running out of time all the time.
Yeah.
So you have that tension within the screenplay. You have the tension in the sport. So anyway, that's just a nerdy basketball tidbit, which is why I think they chose that sport as opposed to some other sport they could have chosen.
Oh, well, actually...
Oh, yeah, like football would not have worked.
No,
yeah.
I
like American football, I mean.
Well, this turns to another dimension of the film, and it comes to that great line, what is it with you Jews and basketball? And this is another dimension.
We haven't talked about this. This is a very funny film.
Yeah, it is. It is really funny.
It's hilarious. But this is the other dimension of it. It deals with a lot of cultural groups within New York. It deals with the Jewish communities, with the African-American community. But again, it's a very authentic lived-in experience. There's a lot of what could be perceived as negative language used, but it's used in a very positive sense. This is a film about a Jewish gem dealer in New York. They could have gone for any number of lazy stereotypes, but they don't. Instead, they talk about the idiosyncrasies of the community, whether it be, again, the Pesach Seder, or talking about quote-unquote Jews and basketball, which is weird. My American Jewish New York family seems to love basketball. I don't quite get it.
Right.
And on the use of language, it's very, very intricate in the movie. There's a great moment where Howard says, it's all copacetic, which is a New York term meaning it's okay, everything's all right. But the way he soundless says it, and it was very clearly intended, it sounds like he's almost saying the Hebrew term kolpaseder, which also means everything's okay. So he's drawing, and the term kolpasedic, it's not just used by the American Jewish community, it's used in the American African-American community, particularly around New York. So he's drawing analogies between these communities throughout. It's really great. It's really intricate.
When you were saying it before that it's really funny, it is, but it's also it's also tragic, but it hits that level, especially towards the end, where it's simultaneously tragic and funny because it's
so
tragic.
When you start laughing and you suddenly start crying because you realize that you were laughing at something which you should be crying about.
It was kind of like that. I was getting that feeling towards the end. And it doesn't. And even though the character's so tragic, it is so funny and so sprightly and fast-moving and intense that it's entertaining as opposed to wallowing in the tragedy of this guy's bad decisions.
He's not pathetic. He's not wallowing in anything.
I think he is pathetic, but he doesn't see himself as pathetic, and I think the film tries to take you.
Yeah, he's more absurd than pathetic. Pathetic would be like, you know, feeling sorry for yourself to that point, you know, or at least you're a bit of a buffoon, but I don't think he is.
I think he has such a high opinion of himself, or always believes that he's able to show people how great he thinks he is.
Yeah, the narcissism that he doesn't kind of like cancels it out.
Spend much time wallowing in the tragedy. He's always looking forward to the next step, high. And he's constantly living in the moment. I really liked the filmmaking. I really liked the sustained intensity of it. The mix of like the handheld cameras and the surveillance, like feeling, which I think adds to the claustrophobia with these zooms and like actual surveillance cameras and far off shots. It feels like there could always be people around there coming closing in. It actually, the way it's shot and staged, reminded me a bit of a Michael Mann movie. You know, he also likes these really intense macho characters. And has that, you know, the sense of like we're always in the moment, something's happening.
Oh, the muscle characters are thoroughly, even they had their own sense of humor. There's also an awkward humor to how some of the more tense sequences are staged, including a great one where a bag has to be passed between two locations.
And really well
just,
staged.
Oh, this is, and again, that led itself to its own just tension-inducing awkwardness. No, there's very little. I mean, my criticisms of it were minor and large and substantial. I really adore this film. It will probably make my top favorite films on the list for 2020.
I think it easily will for me, but I think also this film's going to have a long shelf life because it feels really unique. I think it's something that is going to stick around.
I hope more people talk about it because I think the Parasite sort of,
it's very contemporary in its themes, and but you could compare it to other movies in some regard, but as its own, it feels really like a really strong new vision.
It's fresh, it's new, it's different, and the way it's set up. I mean, the setup is the thing, you know. It's like the screenplay. It's what really makes it work.
Yeah, actually, speaking of the setup, the opening scene, it doesn't take place in the traditional setting of the film. From it.
It wasn't necessary. Right? If the budget was cut, you could cut that, but it adds something for sure.
It gives it a sense of grandeur. It gives it a sense of that this kind of story isn't just situated in this one locality of New York. It gives it a broader sense of universalism.
And it adds to the economic
aspect
of the film.
I agree. Particularly when you see, you know, a worker get hurt in the, you know, the first few seconds of the film. I think that really adds to it as well. You remember, hey, this is actually coming from somewhere. Other people are affected by these actions, not just Sandler and, you know, people in New York.
And the suffering of these workers just underpins us putting a value on this thing so that people can think, oh, it's great, I have this stone. When it's amazing, but it's so meaningless.
Yeah. And not thinking about, all the people that's affected or where it's come from.
Yeah, that little scene was a much better way of, I think, bringing out the point that us spent an entire feature length drawing out. You know, that like behind your happiness, there's somebody who's suffered for it.
You're criticizing us?
I am. I know, that'll send some shockwaves.
I loved that film.
It reminded me of the scene at the beginning of Lord of War where you follow the one bullet being produced and from very beginning to where it is ultimately deployed.
It also, I think, added a kind of mystical element that the film deals with a little bit regarding the stone. Like, it has this significance to the Ethiopian Jews, and now Kevin Garnett think it has some significance to his game, and Adam Sandler is attaching all this significance to it to help sort out his life. But maybe it's this cursed object misery and injury coming from it from the start.
Something about stones, even in Parasite, we had that rock, which has so much significance, which comes back to...
It's an economic symbol.
Yeah.
I'm glad they didn't feel the need to underline that, you know, this is cursed, this will bring you...
No, the film knows to be subtle when it should be. When it has to be,
I mean, the film's called Uncut Gems. It can't be much more clearer than the joke it's making.
But, like, what...
It's a double and you know what double entendre, right?
Just have a film about a MacGuffin which isn't overly dependent on the MacGuffin. Like, yes, it is a central part of it, but it plays second fiddle a lot of the time to the machinations that are going on in Ratner's family or at his business or other... The film's working on a lot of levels at once. It's not just the J.J. Abrams MacGuffin, everything centered on...
Imagine if the whole thing was like, I have to chase this stone. Imagine if it was just a chase movie where he was trying to find the stone.
Imagine if the whole movie was Kevin Garnett stole one individual. Yeah.
It could have easily been that.
Oh, that would have been bad.
That was Aquaman, by the way.
There would have been...
Yeah.
I'm sorry, Aquaman.
I didn't see it either.
No. So that is... It's great. Go see it.
Yeah, it's on Netflix. You have Netflix, don't you?
Wait.
Put Uncut Gems on the list.
Oh, yeah, Uncut Gems. I was like, are you guys recommending Aquaman? What are you doing?
No.
There's so many scenes. There isn't a scene in the film I didn't like. There are so many that just jump out as a favorite. And I adored... the opening sequence where we're just jumping around the jewelry store and getting to know each of the characters. And it's a perfect screenwriting setup because everyone's motivation is very clearly set up. It's something they'll teach in screenwriting classes for sure.
It should be, and it's a real shame that it missed out on an Oscar nod.
It deserved so many Academy Award nominations, I think.
I
also think it gives us a different view of New York to what we normally get in film.
Oh, yeah, it's a lot more street level. Not even the Bronx kind of thing, which usually we get to see.
It's claustrophobic.
Non-glamorous.
Yeah,
but while dealing with the Diamond Street, the Diamond District, and the world, and auctions. You know, it's really an inside of view. I appreciate that.
The auction scene was so good because it was there's always tension in the auction scene, but it was the inverse of how it typically runs. So really, really good. Like I hadn't seen, and I was genuinely not sure how it would end.
Yeah.
Because of the trajectory and how the film had been playing out for Ratner so far. So I loved it. One of the better articulations of an auction sequence.
You know who I was missing in this movie? I really wish Philip Seymour Hoffman was alive, because I was just like, he would fit in this film for sure.
He would
be just like, oh my god.
You know who he would
be? Great.
He would be the older character one character meets at the end.
Maybe.
Yeah, I think of him. Yeah. So that was Uncut Gems. It's on Netflix now. The True History of the Killer Gang is on Stan. What Did Jack Do is on Netflix. Emma, period, is in cinemas tomorrow. And the Oscars are on YouTube. If you care
they're
to
over.
Watch
Elton
John's
they're
performance.
Done. Stop talking about them.
Yeah.
No, they're great. Parasite won.
Parasite won. So next week.
I'm with Farad. I'm just not feeling the excitement.
No,
it's like, yeah, cool.
So
it's cool. Wow, it's cool. Parasite won. Okay.
Yeah, no, I'm happy. I mean, it's better than.
But it's still the
Joker
Oscars.
Winning.
It was going to be 1917.
No. If Joker won, I would probably like not be seen in public for at least 2 weeks because I live in a society.
Can you imagine? Like, it's nice that all these indie cinemas can now be like, we're screening Parasite for another couple of weeks, as opposed to, hey, Joker, we can do a special run of the new.
But it was
Best
never
going
to be
winner.
Joker. I'm with Louise. It was going to be 1917.
Yeah, it's always going to be 1917 or Parasite.
No, but the thing is, Madman. Look at their timing. They released. They've released a black and white version of Parasite to make
good time.
Raking more money.
The thing about the 1917 versus Parasite thing is 1917 is just probably not a movie people
were as
passionate
about. A
gimmick
in search of a movie.
As much as Parasite.
I think that's true.
I think Parasite got people talking, but 1917 is more familiar.
It just had a lot of passion behind it.
Yeah.
That I think.
That's what counts.
I mean, my dad saw Parasite and he doesn't see anything with subtitles.
I think Parasite cut through just because the social divide and social class commentary in the movie just is universal and nailed at a time.
And I think it just felt really
divide.
Fresh. Yes. It just felt really fresh.
Actually,
while being audience pleasing in terms of being a really tight thriller, a comedy that becomes a thriller but is intricately plotted.
Yeah.
This is what my dad said, and he just hates subtitles. So, you know, probably the target audience for this kind of thing. And he's like, I didn't need to read any. I could follow along the images, and that was enough.
Because he's such a great.
Subs.
You're right. That has helped it translate because he's
like,
such an incredible
you're
visual
right,
storyteller.
You're right. You know,
point,
it's like, you know, I didn't need to read any. I didn't need to know to follow the film. I just didn't need to read the subs, and that was okay.
You know, and whoever does the clips for the Oscar shows, please stop putting spoilers because
they always do.
I know.
Spoilers for Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Yeah, I noticed that. There was spoilers for a few. There were spoilers for Marriage Story.
Yeah.
Like the very end scene is one of the
clips.
Which is, I think, the most touching part of the film is one of the clips.
Yeah, they spoiled a lot.
I agree. I don't know why they always do that.
Oh, is that? All
right. Everyone in that room has seen the screeners, haven't they?
Maybe.
Yeah.
I bet some there are people in there who haven't watched all the Best Picture nominees.
Particularly the
Not
shorts,
everyone is like Edgar Wright, who actually goes through and sees everything.
Well,
you should if you're voting.
I try to
see
everything and I don't vote. But... Yeah,
eight. There were eight nominees.
Nine. Go watch
Come on,
nine
like,
movies.
Nine for Best Picture. But then, if you count all the other ones,
then there's a lot.
Yeah, there's a lot.
It's only about 154.
But you work in the industry, and if you want to vote, then
only 154.
Yeah,
movies,
that's right. It's quite
Tom
a lot.
Cruise watches
and
one
and
day.
Also, it was a shorter Oscar season as
so
well than usual because normally it would be a couple of weeks' time from now. Which they've said they're not going to shorten it next time because a lot of people were upset about that.
So
I think
February?
It was the right length.
Yeah,
I was very
it's
happy
normally
with...
around my birthday. Which is 17th of February. I realize
happy
you
birthday.
Know that. So
happy birthday.
Thanks, guys. Yeah, so like, it'd normally be a week or two later.
So Louise's birthday is next week, but also next week we're chatting with Felix Hubble from Static Vision and the Hyperlinks Festival, which again is happening at Pink Flamingo Cinemas in Marrickville from 19th to 21st of February. Also, Fantastic Festival Australia is having their inaugural run at the Ritz next weekend through into March. Previously, they were Paris Cinema Fest in Melbourne, but now they're in Melbourne and Sydney. We'll be back next week. Let us know what you want us to fight about. Louise, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
And we will be back. Have a wonderful night, morning, whenever you're listening. Enjoy movies.
Goodbye. Watch Uncut Gems.
It's great. Bye.
Bye.